I think they like you, Steve.
Live from the Allstate Skyline Studio.
It's the Steve Cochran Show on 720 WGN.
Good morning, Chicago. 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman stepping up for Steve Cochran today and tomorrow. He'll be back on Friday with Cruz here, Mary Sandberg, Dave Ennett, Steve Grzanich, Mary Vandeveld. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You tired?
I am not that tired. I will be honest with you. As a White Sox fan, I did go to Kopech Day. I was really jacked up. I brought my son.
Kopech night.
Right. Well, I celebrated all day.
All day was Kopech Day.
Right. That's true. Sorry.
It was hashtag Kopech Day.
Missed the celebration. Sorry.
Yeah, I celebrated with a nap in the afternoon. It was really nice. But going there, it was exciting. I kept pointing out to Miles. It was like, look at this traffic. Look at it slow down before, you know, look at this. You don't see this every day. This is amazing, right? This traffic? This bumper-to-bumper traffic? And so we had a lot of fun going to the game and for the two innings before it rained. And it was Miles' first rain delay, which he was unimpressed by. I'll be honest.
Really?
Yeah,
why would you not be impressed by it?
I thought maybe perhaps he'd be like the wonder of the tarp and the rain delay, but instead he was like, oh, it's raining.
Were your seats covered or uncovered?
They were uncovered, and the best part, when it was done, we came home and I said, we didn't stay till after the rain delay. Once we realized Kopech was not going to pitch anymore, we said, Dad's got to get up early. I asked him on the way, I'm like, what was your favorite part? Because you got the part where every time Kopech got two strikes, everybody stood up. It had a playoff atmosphere, something you don't see. He hasn't seen in his lifetime at Sox Park. And he said the best part was cleaning off the seats after the rain delay. Like, he had taken his pants and used it as a sponge, and he had cleaned up the seats, and he was very proud of himself.
You know, kids find funny things that they'll remember about being in a ballpark.
Really,
I remember that. I remember if you'd step on the mustard packet, it would send mustard three rows ahead.
It was funny that was what he remembered, and he got really upset because the rain had stopped. He had started working on the seats. He cleaned them perfectly, and then the rain started back up. And they had to bring the tarp back out. It was all one big rain delay. But there was a point where they had cleared the tarp and they were going to play. And then they had to put it back on and wait a couple more minutes.
So Miles' own seat maintenance.
Yeah, he got mad.
Yeah, I get that. You clean it off perfectly and then it gets wet again.
Exactly.
You know, I could not believe how hard it rained there because up north, nothing.
Nothing. Even in the West Loop where I live, my wife was like, there's nothing. It's not raining.
I went out during the rain delay, and there was the moon was shining brightly above. And
but, Dave, we had the rain earlier. We had rain. Oh, you didn't have it? I went over to see the kids at, 4 o'clock, and it was pouring.
Yeah, maybe it was
4 p.m. Yeah, well, because Dave and I live by each other. But I want to know, Dave, as a child, was stepping on mustard packets?
Well, I mean, that's one of the things you would do to amuse yourself in the ballpark.
Very rebellious of you.
Yeah, I can't imagine Dave getting all yellow.
I know.
Not necessarily me. Maybe my friends.
You and your hoodlum
friends.
Which
is kind of one of those things that happens in a ballpark.
Sure. I would, if I saw Patrick Swoot heading for a mustard packet, if there was mustard on his shoe, I would have a heart attack.
It was a different era.
312-981-7200 if you have any shenanigans that you would pull at the ballpark, like stepping on mustard packets, you can give us a ring and let us know. We got a big show lined up. Karen Conti is going to join us in the 6 o'clock hour and talk about all the stories coming out of Washington, both the Paul Manafort trial and, of course, the Michael Cohen plea. So we'll talk about those stories and also its impact on the president. Pat Brady will join us in the 7 o'clock hour. Howard Lerner from the Environmental Law and Policy Center will join us as well, talk about the new plan for the EPA. Under Trump, Andrew Wheeler, the new EPA chief, rolling back some of the regulations that were put in place during the Obama administration when it comes to greenhouse gases and the energy industries, particularly coal. So this will be interesting for what we see as our country, our response to climate change. It seems like this administration is moving in a direction that seems to be against what we thought we wanted our government to do when it came to our planet being destroyed.
Yeah, a little less social responsibility.
Yeah, so, but that might not be, I mean, essentially, that might be the headline, but as you sink into it, there may be a different take. Obviously, this comes down to more of the same when we talk about what is federal responsibility and what is state responsibility. That seems to be what the core of this new plan. Also, Steve James is going to join us, the filmmaker who is behind the new program America to Me on Stars, which is the I mean, it's not. It's getting so much buzz. As yesterday, we had Bing Liu, and he was talking about, you know, considered one of the best television shows of the year. So, Steve James will join us in the 8 o'clock hour. We'll talk about that. Dean Richards, of course, and Marilyn Katz. Marilyn Katz, a young protester in 1968, organizer who was here in Chicago when the 68 convention got underway and was part of the protests and the ensuing riots afterwards. Marilyn Katz joins us as part of our three-part series on the 1968 Democratic Convention 50 years later. So lots to do, right? That was a lot, so we'll get to it. Why don't we do this?
And wait, you left Ro Khanna off the list.
Well, you know. Did I? No. Our buddy Ro Khanna will be here as well, and we'll talk with him. He'll have some insights as well on what's happening in Washington. All right. Coming up to Top 6 at 6.
From the Steve Cochran Auditorium in the lovely Sunrise Hotel, it's time to get your kicks.
Get your kicks. Get your kicks.
Get your kicks. With the Top 6 at 6, sponsored by American Weathermakers Heating and Cooling, the 60 Minute Men.
All right, time for the Top 6 at 6 here on 720 WGN. Number one, former Trump campaign chief Paul Manafort was convicted on 8 counts of fraud and other financial crimes yesterday. The jury was deadlocked on 10 of the other charges, and the judge declared a mistrial. But for some of the more serious charges about fraud and international banking crimes, Manafort was found guilty. He'll be sentenced in September. No word yet on how this might play out for the president, who seemed to distance himself from Paul Manafort yesterday in his rally in West Virginia.
Do they coordinate the sentencing with his other trial? He has another thing that's going to start in September.
Up. Yeah, I think they do. I think they wait till it's all done before they put a full sentence together, right?
I'm not sure. Yeah. We have experts to talk about that at 6:40. Yeah.
Karen and Pat will tell us coming up at 6:40. Former Trump lawyer Michael Cohen will reportedly plead guilty to 8 charges of fraud, including the charge of willfully helping a federal candidate violate campaign law by arranging hush money and not reporting it. Google Stormy Daniels. Wait, don't. Don't Google.
These are two felonies that Cohen has implicated the president in committing.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Because if you report hush money, then it's okay. Is that the...
I guess so. I guess so.
Hush money is wrong because you can't pay to influence an election. That's at the crux of this charge,
right,
is that the president paid to silence both of these women to influence the outcome of the election.
Pat Brady's here. Pat, what do you want to say about that?
It's over the dollar amount. $2,700 is the max you can get. Plus, corporations can't coordinate with campaigns.
I gotcha.
So exactly what Steve said, but that's the
more specific. I just wonder about the whole thing because obviously this is a story that a lot of the American people already know. And so if you're going to get hung up on the technicalities that, yes, this is a felony and that's a serious crime, especially when it comes to campaign violations, but I don't know if this is going to sway public opinion because we've already kind of, this story has played out in the public. That's my thought on that. I'm not sure.
I don't know. I think it's this is the second time in history that a president has been an unindicted co-conspirator. I could be wrong about that. The last time was Nixon.
No, he wasn't an undead co-conspirator.
Nixon wasn't?
No, yeah. Trump wasn't.
Well, yeah, sure he was. In yesterday's plea agreement?
No, it's not.
He was the federal candidate.
Yeah, but he's not named in the information. That was part of the elocution.
With it.
But
yeah,
that's what an unindicted co-conspirator is, right? He was part of the conspiracy directing Michael Cohen, and he wasn't indicted?
The issue is that the president has not been named. They went out of their way to use colorful language to say a federal can't... We all know who it is, but he wasn't
I think it's
named.
Semantics,
but it's semantics,
right?
Well, I think it might be actually... we can talk to Karen about this too, but he was not usually if you're an unindicted co-conspirator, they'll say like individual A.
Oh, I see.
Like they did with Blagojevich cases, yeah.
Interesting.
But I mean, the effect's the same.
Exactly. It definitely is semantics. New EPA chief Andrew Wheeler introduced a plan to roll back emission guidelines put in place by the Obama administration. This was regulations enacted to fight air pollution. But the Trump EPA says that the job of regulating polluting industry should be done at the state level. because, you know, air knows boundaries. We all have different air. This is a win for some of the energy industries, specifically coal, which is the biggest culprit when it comes to greenhouse gases. We'll see how this plays out. It's another, maybe a good question for Pat and for Karen coming up, would be that there's also a little trigger in here. It's very interesting political strategy that if there are, which always happens, advocates sue to try and roll back any sort of new guidelines in an administration. If they sue and lose, it will set precedent, and you won't be able to have a next president or the next president or a different political party go back to the way it was with Obama. They would be dead forever. So that's the idea. So it's very, very interesting play on whether or not you'll see environmental activists and advocates actually put this into the courts. So we'll see. All right. The body of Molly Tibbetts was discovered yesterday in a nearby Iowa cornfield. The University of Iowa student went missing last month. The authorities have charged a man with murder after he led them to the body. The man is an undocumented immigrant, which has stirred up the debate over immigration policy and reform as the president talked about it in his rally in West Virginia yesterday. A really sad story that at least there seems to be some conclusion on it, but a terrible story that seems to be exacerbated by politics, that now it's going to be in the mouths of our politicians talking about the need for reform in an area that I'm not sure. I mean, obviously, you can see it from both sides that it is an issue where, you know, someone who was undocumented in this country, and that is something that is a serious issue and has been advocated at the highest levels, including the president. But at the same time, this is a murder, and it's just not sure if it needs to be played out on a stage like a rally in West Virginia when you're talking about.
And I hope everybody thinks of the parents and the family.
Yeah,
I mean, this
was family.
Brutal.
Right, and also, not all undocumented immigrants are killers or rapists,
and that's the part too, because you could also make the argument too that there's a lot of murder that is, you know, done by Americans as well,
right? Citizens,
Americans, yeah. But I do also understand the idea that if you are an undocumented immigrant living in this country and you commit murder an American on American soil, That's hard to stomach. So anyway, we already got the quack. So to the last one here. Kopech Day was a day to remember for Chicago baseball. First, the young White Sox flamethrower made his debut at Guaranteed Rate Field. He pitched two shutout innings until a one-hour rain delay forced him from the game. But that was hardly the only story in Chicago baseball yesterday. Staying on the south side, White Sox slugger Jose Abreu had emergency abdominal surgery, Dave?
Well, it was termed outpatient surgery for an undisclosed he was having discomfort in his abdomen groin area. They didn't say what the procedure was. He'll resume baseball activities in about 10 days.
Jeez, it came out of nowhere.
Yeah, he had not been, I mean, he'd been hitting
right
lately, and had not,
it showed up on the injury report like he's just skipping the day because he had abdominal,
that's kind of how it sounded at first.
And then they stepped up that since that he will not be back until mid-September. So,
and Lurie Garcia went on the DL, and Ricky Renteria, the manager, was out again. He's missed two games, and he's gonna have some more tests this morning in Chicago. Oof. And so
that's just the south side. On the north side, the Cubs got word that pitcher Yu Darvish is out for the year, which is a huge blow to the Chicago Cubs, who obviously invested in a 7-year future for Yu Darvish, so this is about making him, you know, keeping him healthy for down the road. But Dave, he factored into what they wanted to do in this postseason.
Well, no question, except that he hasn't pitched here in, 3 months?
Yeah, right.
And a stress reaction, not a stress fracture in his right elbow, but a stress reaction is regarded as a precursor to a stress fracture.
Yeah. What the heck is that?
But at least they know
it's
what
like
it was.
It's like a bone bruise, Mayor.
More semantics.
But they know what it was. Yeah, they know what it was now, and that's what Theo Epstein said yesterday, is at least we know what we're dealing with. It wasn't in his head. It wasn't something that anybody was making up. You can see it on the MRI. Apparently.
And then arguably the biggest story, Daniel Murphy, Cub killer, comes to the Chicago Cubs for the stretch run here from the Washington Nationals. Wow, what a move, a small move that was after the trade deadline. He clears waivers, the Cubs get him. I mean, huge impact.
Well, it's amazing because, remember, the Cubs had to go 5 games to beat Washington last year in the playoffs, and everybody assumed they would meet again in the playoffs this year. And Washington's probably been the most disappointing team in baseball. And so all of a sudden, they're sellers now. And Murphy, who has, I think his lifetime batting average at Wrigley Field is in the
3,000.
No, it's 413 at Wrigley.
Oh, wow.
And he's hit 340 since the All-Star break.
Amazing.
And now the Cubs have a homestand coming up beginning tomorrow, and he's going to get a chance to play in Wrigley every home game.
There you go. So it's got to
help, because this team can't score right now, which is remarkable considering the amount of firepower they have.
And Daniel Murphy gives the Cubs a lot of flexibility with the absence of Chris Bryant as well.
Now, when is he coming back, Chris Bryant?
Well, they don't know. And Addison Russell was scratched last night.
Oof.
So
wow, what a Kopech day.
Across
Chicago baseball.
I mean, we're going to remember that on the next Kopech
Day. That's right. All right, that's your top 6 at 6.
That's it!
That's all today for the top 6 at 6.
No more!
Sponsored by American Weathermakers Heating and Cooling, the 60 Minute Men.
I think there is no legal jeopardy to the president from today's verdict. As we all know, this involves things that are not connected to Manafort's work on the campaign or to Manafort's service to Donald Trump. I think at most the president is guilty of making a very poor personnel decision when he chose Manafort to be his campaign chairman.
Please rise. Court is now in session.
WGN, Justin Kaufman in for Steve, stepping up for Steve. The whole gang is here, including Pat Brady this morning. And also on the line, Karen Conti, who joins us regularly here on the program. Karen, good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Justin, Pat, Mary.
Yeah, you can hear Karen, the Karen Conti Show, 7 to 9 on Sundays here on 720 WGN, also Karen Conti Law. All right, so let's first talk about the Paul Manafort verdict yesterday. 8 counts of the 18. What is that signal? What is your reaction to what the jury came back with?
I'm not surprised that there was a conviction, because this was a very strong keeper case. I'm actually surprised that there were hung juries on the other counts. But it doesn't really matter, because as far as the prosecution goes, those 8 counts are going to give him a lot of time in jail if this goes forward. And as you recall, we also have another case against Manafort in another jurisdiction that is set to go to trial in about 3 weeks.
Do you see there's a lot of question of whether or not the prosecution, the government, would be interested in retrying any of those 10 counts? Is that something, like you just said, they got what they needed and they're going to move on?
You know, it's hard to say. They might want to just pound him. They may just want to put his lawyers to work and have him spend some more money on defense. And they might want to retry those cases. I don't know. They seem to be very, very interested in prosecuting him, to say the least. They've been very aggressive with him. And normally speaking, if this happened in Chicago, the prosecutors would probably just say, we've got enough. We're going to put him in jail for the rest of his life unless something happens, and we'll walk away. But here, I'm not so sure.
Yeah. Let's bring in Pat. Politically, the president has done as much as in talking about it last night at the West Virginia rally and otherwhere, saying this has nothing to do with me. And it's a witch hunt on him, but it has nothing to do with me. Is he right?
I mean, I think he's right for the people that support him, and maybe even people that are kind of halfway paying attention, because the reality is this case came well before he was Trump's campaign manager. Doesn't relate to the Russia, quote-unquote, collusion. So I think he's pretty strong when he says that, and people are going to like him for saying that because they like him anyway.
What did we learn, Karen, when it comes to the legal case against Paul Manafort? What did we learn about this case? I mean, we were inundated with stories about how he bought ostrich coats and other extravagant things. But what do we know? I mean, what is it for the American people? Is this just a straight up bank fraud case?
Well, it is. I mean, here was a guy who was making millions of dollars, and when he was making money, he was hiding it from the government and illegally not paying taxes on it. When he was not making money anymore, he was lying to the banks to get more money. So this guy, you know, this guy was a bad guy from a financial standpoint. And Pat is right. There's really nothing came up in the trial that really connects him to Trump. But if you look at this guy's background, and you can read all you want about it on the internet, he was dealing with a lot of unsavory characters in Russia. Does that have any connection to Trump? We don't know, and I haven't seen anything that definitively says there was a connection. But I think it's fair to say that Trump aligned himself with some bad people. I mean, the thing that, you know, I'm sure we're going to talk about is the Michael Cohen plea of guilty. I mean, we've got all of these people around him who have shady backgrounds and are, you know, when you shine the light on their business dealings, you know, they've been committing fraud for years and years. So,
well, you know, Karen, again, they're Republicans. They're anti-tax. They just don't pay their taxes.
Hey, I have a question.
That's one way to do it. You know, why wait for the laws to change? Just don't pay.
Steve? Go ahead, Steve.
I have a question. This may be for Pat or Karen. A lot of conversations in this trial, in the Manafort trial, were under seal, and the idea is that a lot of those conversations had to do with that connection to the special counsel. Are we ever going to get to see what was said by the lawyers and the judges that is so important that it was kept under seal?
I believe we are, and it may be after this whole investigation is done and all the prosecutions are done and the trials are finished. But I think they have the authority to seal those records. But generally speaking, they do come out in the end.
Michael Cohen, of course, pleaded guilty to 8 counts, again, fraud, bank fraud, other financial stuff. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, let's get into that, because that may have more to do with the president than this case with Paul Manafort. Karen Conti on the line with us, joins us regularly. The Karen Conti Show can be heard on WGN 7 to 9 Sunday nights. And, of course, Conti Law, Karen Conti Law.
Mr. Cohen has knowledge on certain subjects that should be of interest to the special counsel, and is more than happy to tell the special counsel all that he knows, not just about the obvious possibility of a conspiracy to collude and corrupt the American democracy system in the 2016 election, which the Trump Tower meeting was all about, but also knowledge about the computer crime of hacking and whether or not Mr. Trump knew ahead of time about that crime and even cheered it on.
Karen Conti with us. Karen, of course, the host of the Karen Conti Show on Sunday nights here, 7 to 9, and also Conti Law in Chicago. We're talking some about the legal stories that came out yesterday, including Michael Cohen, Trump's former lawyer, pleading guilty to 8 counts of 8 charges of bank fraud, essentially, some other campaign violations as well. Karen, what do you make of the plea coming out and pleading guilty for Michael Cohen?
I'm not surprised, but it's kind of interesting that the Manafort verdict sort of overshadowed this particular plea. And this is the first thing that really ties Donald Trump to crime. And basically he said that he did these things. He paid off these women from campaign funds in coordination with and at the direction of a candidate for federal office who became the president. And we can guess who that is. So this really does tie Donald Trump to a particular crime. Whether or not he's going to be credible, I think he's said different things at different times, whether or not he has evidence, but what you just played there seems to foreshadow maybe there's stuff that we don't know about that might have been in some of the recorded conversations or the documents in Cohen's office. So we will see.
That was Michael Cohen's lawyer, Lanny Davis, speaking to the press yesterday. That's really the question everybody has, is does Michael Cohen have more or something that he gave the government to plead out, essentially, in this case? I mean, is that what we should assume, the fact that he's pleading guilty on these counts, that he's cooperating?
Absolutely. And I think there was probably more, if you read between the lines. Michael Cohen has had many businesses. He had taxi cabs in New York, and there was apparently some allegation that he had committed crimes in getting money for those businesses. So things unrelated to Donald Trump, but I think the heat was on him to plead guilty. He pled guilty, and it was kind of an interesting twist. They said that he consented to a sentence between 46 and 53 months, which is a long time in jail, a very long time in jail. So they're going to keep the heat on him, and they're going to have him testify at some point. And this is really heating up. I would say that in the next month, we're going to see all kinds of things happen. It's been slow at first. I think people have been frustrated with the length of this investigation. But now with these guilty pleas and guilty verdicts, we're going to have people either being pardoned or they're going to turn on the people up the line.
And the question that was out before the verdicts and the guilty pleas was whether or not Robert Mueller was going to subpoena Trump to testify. There was questions. Rudy Giuliani was talking about this over the weekend, that he wouldn't necessarily approve of something like that. So where are we with that? I mean, do you think that Mueller would subpoena the president?
Well, I have three reasons why he hasn't done it. Either Mueller has enough evidence, and he has enough evidence against the people he's targeting, whether that is Roger Stone or Jared Kushner or Donald Trump himself. Number two, it could be that he doesn't want to subpoena Trump because then the Trump is going to invoke a legal privilege, and it's going to go up to the Supreme Court, and it's going to further delay the investigation, which I think Mueller probably doesn't want to do. And finally, it could be something even more serious, which is if you are a witness, you get a subpoena. If you are a target, meaning they are going to prosecute you and they intend to prosecute you, the Department of Justice standard says we don't send subpoenas to people who are targets because they're just going to take the fifth anyway, and that's our procedure. So if you look at who hasn't been subpoenaed here, Roger Stone, Jared Kushner, Donald Trump Jr., and our President Donald Trump, those are the four people who have not yet been subpoenaed. Are those people targets? Perhaps.
And we'll talk.
Don't get a subpoena, you get one of those target letters. That's a bad day.
It's a bad day.
That's a really bad day. Yeah.
And we'll
yeah.
talk more about that, the political ramifications that with Pat coming up here at the beginning of the 7 o'clock hour.
Karen, if he does go, if the president was subpoenaed and did the legal privilege thing, it goes further up. Does that end for you? Do you think, like, does he eventually, do they agree and make him?
I mean, scholars have gone back and forth on this issue, and I won't pretend to be one. But I think that the president does have to comply with the subpoena. Would he have to testify? It could be that the court says that a sitting president should not testify. It would set a bad precedent that, you know, a sitting president could, you know, be taken away from his job duties. I just don't think it's going to happen. I don't think that Mueller's going to do it, and I don't think that Giuliani's going to allow it.
One last question before I let you go here quickly. Of course, the Jason Van Dyke trial is going to begin, and we saw that the prosecution is saying that they're going to give immunity to Chicago police officers who would testify against Van Dyke. What does that mean?
Well, there were several police officers who supposedly covered up the shooting and did some paperwork that covered up what really happened. Now, these people would have invoked their Fifth Amendment privilege because they're also being charged. Now, when the prosecution says, we're not going to prosecute you for truthful testimony that you give at trial, they are going to be forced to trial and forced to testify. Now, what are they going to say? Are they going to support their officer brother, or are they going to, you know, say what really happened? This is a bad day for Van Dyke, because I would guess that they're going to try to cut deals with these officers and say, if you testify truthfully against Van Dyke, we're going to drop all charges against you. So let's see what happens in that regard.
And that's coming up after Labor Day, right? That trial begins in September.
Yes, it does.
That's going to be what a show in Chicago. Karen Conti, you can hear her on Sunday nights, 7 to 9, here on 720 WGN, and also Conti Law in Chicago. Karen, thanks for joining us. Great.
Have a great day.
There you go. All right. So lots to talk about. Pat, let's throw around the idea of what's actually happening here in politics after 7 o'clock. Obstruction of justice seems to be is thrown around, and obviously campaign violations we're getting with Michael Cohen. But what's really at play here?
Here's another maybe thought. And for Democrats, and Eric, you can ask him tomorrow, Democrats, be careful what you wish for, because now the energy in the Democratic Party, in my opinion anyway, is with the progressives, the left, mm-hmm. who hate Trump. And now that we actually have somebody in court saying that Trump was involved in this campaign finance law violation, I want him impeached. How are you going to run in those districts or jack up your base if you're going to say, you know, I'm not so big on impeachment? Because I think most people realize, and Erica said this, impeachment nobody wants, and it's not a winner for Democrats. So it's kind of be careful what you wish for.
Let's talk about that coming up here in the 7 o'clock hour. More to come here on the Steve Cochran Show. Stay with us.
Live from the Allstate Skyline Studio.
This is the Steve Cochran Show
on 720 WGN.
Steve Cochran Show here. Justin Kaufman stepping up for Steve. We'll be back on Friday. He's got to be kicking himself today, right? Today's like, this is a Steve Cochran dream come true day when it comes to all the stories coming out of Washington. I thought about that last night when I was going to bed. I'm like, oh, poor Steve.
I thought he's probably going to do a show for the people he's on the golf course with today. Yeah. Like,
see, that's the thing.
Dirty, it's, angry.
It's also a dream day for him because he's on the golf course and the sun is shining.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah, but he's missing out. But Pat Brady is here to fill us in on some of the stuff that, of course, can be confounding and confusing when it's just scrolled nonstop on the cable news. But this is, as Karen Conti mentioned in the 6 o'clock hour, it's heating up. This is a serious day for the president as his former campaign chief gets convicted of 8 counts of essentially fraud, some other stuff, financial improprieties as well. But also his former lawyer pleads to 8 charges, to guilty counts. I mean, this is that one is probably way more important, the Michael Cohen stuff, over the Paul Manafort stuff.
Yeah, you mentioned in the previous hour how much of this is already baked into the political cake of people's opinions. But the thing is with Cohen, this is a self-inflicted wound. Had he not fired Comey?
James Comey, yeah.
James Comey, yeah. A year and a half ago, there would be no Michael Cohen. There would be no special counsel. This would be a Russian investigation going through the Justice Department, which to date we don't have any evidence of conspiracy to conspire with the Russians. So you know, it's kind of a self-inflicted wound.
We were kind of talking about this earlier. This idea that, you know, from what you have to kind of separate with the president is, especially when it comes to the Russian investigation, is he have evil intent or is he a wheeler dealer in the way that he has done this throughout his whole career, where he has been lax in the rules, asking for forgiveness instead of permission. I mean, he's a real estate developer by trade, and he kind of did this in the campaign where he's like, I'll deal with the rules later. I'll shake this hand and shake this hand. We got to win this election, and it's catching up to him. That part of it, I think the American people can be like, yeah, maybe he just wasn't paying attention to the rules, or maybe he just needed to do what he needed to do to win.
Or he had stripper problems.
Or stripper problems.
In the middle of a campaign.
Right. But the bigger issue to me is the obstruction of justice stuff, because you start to see a trail, and this is where Cohen comes in as well, where you start to see the lies and the cover-up and the push payments and all this kind of stuff that says he knew he was breaking the law. He knew he was skirting the rules, not just sort of being his wheeler-dealer self.
Oh, sure. Sure. I mean, if you look at what happened yesterday in the plea and what he said actually happened, if you believe Cohen, there are a lot of reasons you might not want to believe him. But it's a problem. But again, this is going to go into the political hemisphere here pretty soon. And the Democrats, who will likely win the House back, are going to have to figure out what to do with it. Are they actually going to try and impeach a president? And the last two impeachments we had, the first article of impeachment was obstruction of justice.
Right.
Pat, can I play devil's advocate to what you said earlier about there not being evidence of Russian collusion? Wasn't the email from the folks arranging that Trump Tower meeting about we're with Russia, we have dirt, and will you meet with us? And then they met with them. Isn't that evidence of Russian collusion or attempted collusion?
Yeah, there's two things. There's collusion, which could be that, and then there's legally conspiracy. And did he formulate the intent, or these people formulate the intent, to engage in a conspiracy to defraud the United States? I haven't seen that evidence yet. I'm not saying that that meeting wasn't bad or shows some indication that they were playing footsie with the Russians, but insofar as it being enough to bring an indictment against a sitting president, I don't think we've seen it yet.
Yeah, by design, too. I don't know if Robert Mueller is showing everything that he has.
Sure.
But, you know, you mentioned
he's
Democrats.
Been very good.
He has been
and
good,
Ken
yeah.
Starr is kind of surfacing lately, which to me was a great example of how not to do it, where you have a press conference, you walk out every day with a cup of coffee and talk to the press. Robert Mueller, a true prosecutor, not a professor like Ken Starr was, is doing it the right way. And I do have a lot of confidence in whatever he does, one way or another, that it's going to be justice is going to be served.
You mentioned it's getting into the political sphere next, and Democrats who obviously would have an upper hand when it comes to the midterm elections. But let's talk about the Republican Party, because you have leaders in both chambers at this point who have been pretty silent on what's been happening with the president. You've had intelligence committees as well, led by Republicans, who have been even gone out of their way to discredit this investigation. What do they do about the plea that just came out yesterday?
Well, the ones that have done that, and we've talked about them many times, have done a disservice to the country not doing an oversight investigation into what happened in the election. A huge disservice to this country not doing that. Politically, though, on the other side, I don't have as much problem with some of the leadership not speaking up and just letting this investigation run its course, which I think Speaker Ryan has done. But as we talked about in the last hour a little bit, I think the bigger risk is for the Democrats who don't step up and say, I want impeachment, which I believe is politically fatal to Democrats because the country doesn't really want impeachment. I don't think they ever do. It's bad for the economy.
For Republicans as well, you've seen in some, we talked about last week, this idea of some of the primaries that we saw in gubernatorial races around the country, and this idea of Trump-backed candidates and established candidates. As we get to the midterm, are you going to see more of that where the vote that comes out is going to be a Trump vote or a Republican vote?
Well, a couple things could happen. We've got, what, 75 days. We've seen a lot of energy, and Eric has talked about this at length, a lot of energy in these special elections with the Democrats, and they've gotten a big turnout. But if the Democrats are forced into a spot where they have to talk about impeaching the president every day, I guarantee you're going to energize Republicans that support Trump and maybe even others who don't want impeachment, don't think it's a good idea.
Do you think if they don't go that way, if meaning that they just kind of let Trump, as he has, as you pointed out at the beginning of this conversation, these are self-inflicted wounds. If they just stay out of the president's way and talk about they don't like his policies and they don't like the possibility of colluding with foreign agents, but leave impeachment off, you think that's better for the strategy in the midterm?
I think it is for the Democrats, but in all the years I've been doing this, I've never really seen anybody that's that disciplined. It's red meat for Democrats. Yeah. It just is.
As these continue to go on, how does this affect a second term if we don't end up with an impeachment for him, or how they carry this stuff out?
Well, it's all bad. We saw what happened with President Clinton when we had an impeachment proceeding going on. I believed all along that we focused on that as Republicans, and I was on board with it too, but we ignored Osama bin Laden. And look, I'm not saying that there's a direct cause and effect, but I think I'd rather have the president and the Congress focusing on things that impact the country and people's everyday lives than these investigations. I'm investigated right, out in the last 40
no,
years.
No, absolutely. But if it becomes more and more apparent and an investigation bears fruit that there was obstruction of justice, from your perch, do you say, okay, resign, step aside?
Well, I've said all along I thought there's a pretty clear obstruction case, but there's also, it's not clear if you can indict a sitting president, and it's also not clear if it's actually good for the country to go through an impeachment process. And
would you say, though, to the president, like not unlike with Nixon, just say, you know what, maybe best for the country for you to step down?
You know, and they talk about the bipartisan nature of what went on in Watergate, which is really nonsense. It was very partisan. It broke at the very end when it was clear that he was going to be impeached, and people went to him and said, you got to step down. I don't think we're anywhere near that right now, particularly with a Republican Party and these gerrymandered maps, that Trump is still very popular with the Republican base. So if you're going to step out and do that, and you've got a primary now or anticipate one in 2 years, you're taking a big risk doing that.
We're far from that, though.
Pat, what would be the level of Republicans doing that Nixon-type stuff? Let's say the special counsel comes back with his report, and it's full of multiple criminal acts on the part of the president. Do you still say, okay, it's not worth impeaching the president because of the economy? Or when do the Republicans go to the White House and say, you know what, we can't have a criminal in the White House?
Well, I think what you need to do is go through the process. There is a process for Congress to impeach the president, and they need to go through the Judiciary Committee and have hearings and make that determination then.
Last thing real quick. Locally, we talked about the gubernatorial race, big poll that came out today showing that J.B. Pritzker has a wide lead, surprising as these two candidates have been seem to be neck and neck for a while. What's your take on this, the idea of a poll in August that shows, what, a 16-point lead for J.B. Pritzker?
Well, let me tell you a story, young man. Back in 2010, when I was party chairman, we had an event in Bloomington, Illinois, Bill Brady's hometown, with Mayor Giuliani, as it turns out. And there was a poll Labor Day weekend, and I got up and proudly announced that Bill Brady had a 15-point lead. And we didn't see Governor Bill Brady. So a lot of these... I've seen other polling that has a lot closer. If you're J.B. Pritzker, are you happy with that? Absolutely. But I'm not sure. I haven't seen a lot of polling in the last couple cycles have been completely accurate. In fact, in 2014, I sat in the other studio with a pollster about every other week and told me that Pat Quinn was up 5 points, and he told me that 2 days before the election, Governor Rauner won by five. Yeah. So that was a 10-point swing. So, I mean, is it good news for J.B.? Yeah, if you're on that campaign, you like to hear that, but I don't think either campaign is putting a lot of stock
in
this
still
poll.
A long way to go. Yeah. Pat Brady usually joins us with Eric Edelstein, heading out west this week, so he will miss tomorrow. We'll talk with Eric tomorrow.
Pat. Oh, you keep Eric under control. If I'm not here, he tends to get out of control.
Good to see you.
Thanks, guys. See ya.
I was running.
Back to the Steve Cochran Show.
720 WGN. Justin Kaufman stepping up for Steve today. The crew's all here. 312-981-7200 coming up at 7:30. After the 7:30 news, Howard Lerner's going to join us from the Environmental Law and Policy Center. We'll break down what it means for the new EPA chief who has rolled back regulations, Obama-era regulations, when it comes to greenhouse emissions, greenhouse gases in the energy industry. So we'll talk about that coming up and what it means for Illinois and Chicago and the Midwest in general. But first, the most valuable person on the planet today, Wednesday, August 22nd, has to be, and this is a great story, and this is a story that I've covered at WBEZ and other places that I've worked. Dr. Conrad Worrell is a Chicago activist, a former track athlete, and he is the guy who brought the Gately Indoor Track and Field facility, a state-of-the-art 139,000 square foot track facility that includes the area's first bike 200 meter track, 8-lane track, all sorts of track and field events to the south side to Pullman, and he is on the line with us now. Dr. Worrell, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me this morning.
And good to talk to you. This is a big deal. This has been something you've been working on for decades, to bring a track and field, a stadium, if you will, to the south side, to Pullman. Talk about what it means to be a part of that groundbreaking ceremony this past weekend.
Well, it's quite an experience when you've worked on something for 35 years. Formerly, even before Harold Washington's administration, we were talking about how we could figure out how to politically push to create the resources to develop an indoor track. As you know, students in Chicago public schools for years and years and right on up to now practice and have track meets in the hallways because there are no indoor track facilities. So in 1983, the first meeting I had with Mayor Washington was to bring this issue up, and he said to me, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Harold, you were on track at DuSable. As a matter of fact, yeah, you were a city champion in the hurdles in 1939. So throughout his administration, we were trying to find resources, and of course, Harold passed on. We continued our advocacy into the Bailey administration, right up to Chicago's effort to get the 2016 Olympics. That went south, and so the project went south. Unfortunately, as a result of my living in the 8th Ward and my alderman, the great Michelle Harris, we lobbied her. She set up a meeting with Mayor Emanuel. I brought my good friend L.T. Higginbottom, who's one of the big developers in real estate kahunas in Chicago, who I actually ran track against in the 50s. He was a great track and field athlete out of Bloom. He went to Wisconsin. He was an All-American 400-meter runner. We went in and put the pressure on Rahm Emanuel and his administration and Mike Kelly with the Park District. And out of that meeting, there was a commitment to push to find the resources to develop this state-of-the-art indoor track facility that's so long overdue. And we're ecstatic at the potentiality and possibility it has to revitalize track and field here in this city.
Dr. Worrell, when you set out to do this, you probably knew it would take some time. What did you think the time was going to be? 35 years probably wasn't in your mind.
Well, I thought it was going to be right next to my school where I was a professor for 40 years, the Carruthers Center for Inner City Studies of Northeastern Illinois University at Oakwood and Langley. During that era, there was a vacant lot next to my school. There was an eyesore. And Rob Mayer, who was the Commissioner of Economic Development, we had our eyes set on that property, which is now Mandrake Park. So I thought that we were going to get it done under Harold, but his untimely transition took that off the table. So we have a group that I've been related to for many years called Friends of Track and Field. A lot of these young men and women ran track in high school. Some of the men, we actually ran track against each other and with each other at Hyde Park High School back in the 1950s. So this group, along with many other supporters, have been working collectively and supporting my efforts to do the political work to bring this reality into existence. This is a great day for Chicago in terms of the possibility of revitalizing track and field.
It's great, and it'll be open in a year from now, August 2019. What does it mean to for kids, quickly, just about track and field, to give kids in Chicago, especially in the south side of Chicago, and Pullman,
well,
what does track and field mean?
As much as I love basketball, we've become basketballized, and there are other sports that our people can participate, particularly in the African-American community. There's a great track and field tradition in Chicago that has been lost, and particularly even before Title IX, the great Mayor Daley Youth Foundation that provided an opportunity for many African-American women to run track, who went on to college on track scholarships. Many of them went to Tennessee State, the great Tennessee State Tiger Bell. So this has a positive, and a lot of young people are not aware that if you become a great track and field athlete, you can become a professional these days and make considerable income. We have Shamir Little right now out of Lynn Bloom High School, went on to college, ran for a couple of years, and she is one of the top 400-meter runners in the world at this moment. So it has great potential, and I might point out that part of the architectural design of the indoor track facility will include headquarters for After School Matters, and kudos to Melody Hobson, who donated $15 million to this project to push us over the cliff, along with Exelon $5 million. Yeah. So this really has some great potential for after school programming, including this state-of-the-art track and field facility that's so long overdue in this city.
Dr. Conrad Worrell, the man who has brought us the new indoor track facility, Gately Park, 744 East 103rd Street, which will be open in a year. The groundbreaking was this weekend. He's our most valuable person on the planet for today, Wednesday, August 22nd. Dr. Worrell, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it. Congratulations.
And thank you so much for having me.
All right. How great is that?
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Exelon is a big partner in this project
as
well.
It's such a great story. It's a feel-good story to bring track and field back to Chicago. So exciting. And I know a mission of Dr. Worrell for 35 years to get that done.
In a world where we need immediate response, 35 years is a long time to put something into a project.
All right. We'll take a break. We'll come back, and then we'll talk a little bit about the new power plant coming from the EPA. So stay with us.
This is the Steve Cochran Show
on 720 WGN.
Steve Cochran Show here. Stepping up for Steve. Justin Kaufman today, but everybody's here. Sandberg's here. Dave Bennett, Steve Grzanich, Mary Vandeveld, Pete and Joe. 312-981-7200. One of the big stories yesterday, overshadowed completely by, of course, the legal stories, both with Paul Manafort and Michael Cohen, has to do with the Environmental Protection Agency announcing a replacement for President Obama guidelines that were set up for greenhouse gas emissions. This is a big deal that the Environmental Protection Agency, now run by Andrew Wheeler, announced a new plan to give more power to states to control their own emissions guidelines. This is a big story, and one that, again, completely overshadowed and not talked about enough about how we're dealing with pollution and climate change in this country. It's strange to think that this is something that is such a big deal to our planet, and yet a fourth story in the news.
Do we know enough? Has enough time elapsed from when these were put in place during the Obama administration till now, if there's been a difference?
Good question to ask, and Howard Lerner is the guy who can answer it. He is the president and executive director of the Environmental Law and Policy Center, which operates here in Chicago. But also, we can talk a little bit about how this new policy will affect Chicago and the Midwest and the state of Illinois. Howard, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Glad to join you.
So Mary's question is a good one. For the guidelines that were put in place back in, I think it was 2015, have we seen, do any of these guidelines, first, have they even been enacted? And second, is there any way for us to determine whether or not they've had any success?
Well, first of all, Scott Pruitt, before he became the EPA administrator, and he's, of course, now been forced to resign, was the Attorney General of Oklahoma. And what he did was lead the charge to try to keep the Clean Power Plan standards from taking effect. But we've had a lot of progress over the last several years, Mary. What's happened in Illinois, and it's happened in many states, is the old, highly polluting, not very economic coal plants have been shutting down. Cleaner renewable energies coming in, like wind power and solar power, energy efficiency is working. There's a lot of natural gas coming in. So what's happening here is we're beginning to clean up. But this is a policy that's come out of the Trump EPA yesterday while everything was going on with Michael Cohen and Manafort and so forth, while the presidency is getting discredited. Trump's EPA puts out a move us backwards plan. And what's happening is while the U.S. and the rest of the world is moving forward to cut carbon pollution, which we have to do to help solve our climate change problems, the Trump EPA is coming out with policies that would move us backwards.
Well, Howard, let me ask you, because we've talked about this a lot on the download. This was something that we just discussed, the power plan and the clean power plan. I'm intrigued by the argument that that the EPA is bringing forth, this idea that this should be a state's issue, that states should be able to control their own emissions. How does that work when we all share the same air?
Well, you just said it, Justin. That's the practical problem. When it comes to the Great Lakes, you know, say Lake Michigan, which is Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, and Michigan, if Indiana is putting a lot of pollution into southern Lake Michigan, it's going to affect us here in Illinois. When it comes to the atmosphere, you know, if you have a coal plant that's in northern Indiana and it's pumping out pollution, where you have a coal plant in Missouri doing that, it's going to affect the air quality in Illinois. For carbon pollution, CO2, it doesn't matter whether it comes from Iowa, Illinois, or Indiana, or for that matter, from Indonesia. So if Illinois is making progress, but Missouri isn't stepping up and doing its fair share, then we still have a real serious problem because it's one atmosphere.
Well, I think, Howard, their argument is that each state is more better equipped to deal with what they should regulate because each state does different things. You know, there's not a coal issue in California, you know, so I think that's their argument.
Well, it's their argument, but it doesn't make any sense when you really look at what's going on. First of all, the Clean Power Plan that was passed during the Obama administration did leave it to the states. It said, states, you figure out how to solve the problem best in your state. And Mary, that's your point. But we're going to make sure that the federal government oversees it so that there aren't a few states that are stepping up and the rest of them are laggards, okay? Mm-hmm. It doesn't work if Illinois says we're going to step up and Missouri doesn't. Right. So what the Obama administration did was say, as you're suggesting, Mary, hey, states, figure it out in your own way in your own states, but we're going to make sure you get it done. What they're doing now is saying, hey, states, we're just going to leave it to you. And the predictable result, of course, is that some states will step up and get the job done and some won't. But because, as you both pointed out, it's one atmosphere. And if one state pumps a lot of pollution in the air next to another state, then we're not getting progress.
Where does this
is an abdication of the federal government's role.
My question is, who is this placating? Is this something that was lobbied by the energy industry, the coal industry? And this is something that, you know, we saw the president even in West Virginia yesterday, but this idea that that's what he ran on, the idea of bringing back some of these industries, because even in his own words, even the EPA said themselves, this is not going to save the coal industry. There already have been choices made for natural gas and other renewable energy sources, so this won't bring back the coal industry. But so who is actually advocating for this?
Well, this is a sop by the Trump EPA to the political donors and to the industries that have been supporting the president. Andy Wheeler, who's the head of the Trump EPA now, lobbied for the coal industry. So what's going on here is the lobbyists and the political donors that have supported Trump out of the coal industry, the Bob Murrays of the world of Murray Energy, who runs coal mines, they're getting here what they want. The difficulty, of course, is exactly what you're pointing out. It's, you know, the president going to West Virginia and saying, I'm going to bail out the coal industry, is akin to the president 20 years ago going to Rochester, New York, and telling people who made camera film, we're going to bail you out. The fact of the matter is we've moved to digital cameras. Right. And while a couple of high-end photographers may still use film, most of the rest of us use our cell phones or a digital camera. You can't bail out landline phones, the film industry, the camera film industry. So the president's going and devoting his resources to making a false promise to people that somehow he's going to resurrect the coal industry, when the fact of the matter is there are better products coming into the market. There's lower priced natural gas. There's energy efficiency. There's lower cost solar and wind power coming in. But what you're seeing is the administration doing everything it can in terms of changing policy to try to subsidize the older coal plants that are highly polluting, like those in central and southern Illinois, to keep running longer. And what that means is more pollution that's going to happen for more years that harms our public health and our environment. America needs to move forward. That's what the public wants, not move backwards here.
Howard, my last question quickly. I saw a couple of stories about the legal precedent. If advocates or activists want to sue over this process and they lose, this could actually harm future presidents or future administrations being able to revert back to the guidelines that were set up by the Obama administration. Did I read that correct?
Well, I think the reality of the legal process is, first, there needs to be a rulemaking before the US EPA. And the Environmental Law and Policy Center and our colleagues will be very engaged in that. The current proposal out of the US EPA, we don't think, is legally supportable. But we'll see what happens as the rulemaking process goes on. Hopefully, EPA will be persuaded to reverse course and do something better. If they're not, we'll look at where the circumstances are there, and if need be, we'll file a lawsuit and go into court. Yeah. The current proposal is not legally supportable.
We'll continue to cover this. Howard Lerner, President and Executive Director of the Environmental Law and Policy Center. Howard, thanks for joining us this morning. I appreciate it.
Good to join you this morning. Take care.
There you go. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out, because I do find it fascinating that the EPA has set it up that if there are challenges, legal challenges to it, as Howard said, it's legally unsupportable, and they lose that challenge in the court of law, that would set precedent. So we would have to create a whole new power plan off of this power plan in the next administrations to come.
That's the second time that's come up today, setting the precedent that'll change things forever.
It seems like that's all we're doing right now is just setting precedent. All right, let's take a quick break and then we'll come back. Coming up in the 8 o'clock hour, Dean Richards, of course, and also Steve James, the documentary filmmaker who's behind the new show on Starz called America to Me. Spent a year, Bing Liu was telling us yesterday, spent a year in Oak Park River Forest High School, really exploring race and race relations in that school, which is touted as one of the most integrated schools in America. So we'll have Steve James on the program coming up.
Back to the Steve Cochran Show
on 720 WGN.
312-981-7200. We're going to be talking about the 50th anniversary of the Democratic National Convention next week, Tuesday the 28th. Will be the actual day of the anniversary, but we've been doing our three-part series with Ryan Burrow. He's got his second piece today, and we're going to talk with Marilyn Katz. Marilyn Katz, one of the protest organizers, really has been a longtime voice of political activist here in Chicago, but she was a young woman at the protests, and we're going to talk with her coming up in the 9 o'clock hour about her recollections and commemorate the anniversary. Is that right? Commemorate?
Yes. Observe.
Observe?
It's one of those things that needs more time than just, 20 minutes on a radio show. It's something you should do for your downloads on the website with You Should Have Walter and Marilyn.
Right.
They
would
be great. Hour-long
sit-down. Do a Ken Burns, 14-hour.
Yeah, exactly. 14 hours.
14-hour podcast. You like those, Dave, right?
Oh, yeah.
Who doesn't
yeah.
like the 14-hour podcast? We'll get that done.
Ladies and gentlemen,
Dean Richards joins us from Channel 9.
Citizens of the world,
some of the world's greatest entertainers are here tonight.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I present to you?
And tonight, guess what? It's going to be Dean.
Yeah, honey, you know I love you more than one.
The great Dean Richards joining us. I always forget what we call this. The mothership? the TV station?
From Channel 9.
Channel 9.
The firstborn.
The firstborn.
WGN.
The ground.
Actually, I think the radio station was firstborn.
Oh, really?
I just meant the favorite then.
The facilities are great up at the TV station.
There are. Yeah. I was just there on Friday, though. Dean and
so
I.
So you
never
say.
I
saw some pictures where you were somehow photoshopped into pictures that looked like WGN TV. I did not actually see you.
I was chasing you around, but you were very busy. People flocked to you, so
I'm not big
on waiting in line to see Dean.
Right. You're right. Don't fight me. I wouldn't be either.
Dean Richards, of course, joins us every morning, 8 o'clock. Lots to talk about this morning. Aretha Franklin, Post Malone, in a story that has been everywhere. Yeah, scary story about the airplane. A Veronica Mars reboot. Also, Barbara Harris, Second City co-founder, dies. Danny Boyle out. And a lot to talk about this morning. Why don't we start with Aretha Franklin? No will. What?
Boy, you hear about these stories all the time, right? Of people who don't have wills, don't have trusts, have not made some sort of arrangement for when they pass away. I guess you just don't think that somebody, with as many assets as Aretha Franklin, you know, certainly must have had, that there would just be no will, that it would just be, you know, something that's left hanging like that. But some people just do not want to deal with putting a will together and, you know, dealing with the possibility that they might die.
Unbelievable.
It's going to happen. Guess what? It's going to happen.
Well, we've heard so much about how Aretha Franklin dealt with money. I mean, just in the stories I read in the last week about how she took cash for her gigs and anecdotal stories of her taking the cash, putting it in her bra, and then going perform the show.
Who hasn't?
Yeah, right. Who hasn't done that? But also,
I have about $200 in mind right now.
Exactly. That she, you know, net worth of $80 million, whatever it might be. But so to think that she doesn't have a will is a little confusing.
Yeah. It's going to go to probate now, which number one will put it into public view. You know, her private assets are going to go to probate court in the state of Michigan now. It's going to be out there for everybody to see and hear. And already, as also, you know, what happens when somebody passes away. I'm not saying that her family is fighting over it yet, but her four sons have stepped up and filed documents saying that they are interested parties in the estate. So a judge is going to have to decide this, but also a niece has stepped forward saying that she should be named as the representative of the estate. Oof. So a potential battle is lurking there. In the state of Michigan, apparently if there's no will, the person's assets are divided equally among the children. Huh. So what that means to a niece who is saying that she should be named as part of this as well, and you know, if it's anything like Prince's estate afterwards, where dozens of people were coming forward saying that they were children and they, you know, claimed some sort of ownership to the Prince estate. Hopefully that's not going to happen with this one.
Right.
But get a will, everybody. Yeah. Get a will. Get a trust made. You know, you can do it in a form. You can do it online in a computer thing. It doesn't have to be a super fancy thing. But
protect that cash in your bra.
I think sometimes people plan to and never get around to it. Yeah. I know my mom's dad was an attorney and didn't have a will. And she was 30. I was 10 when he passed away. And it went on forever, like a good 12 or 13 years, settling the estate issues.
Yeah, so. Especially if you're going on a trip, like, you know, without your family, if it's just parents going on a trip, make sure you have a will. Just, you never know. I mean, I hate to say it, but that's when we first made our first will.
Well, I mean, I guess that's right. That's when it strikes you that something may happen while I'm gone. But the fact of the matter is, you're actually more likely to be crossing the street in front of your house and get hit by a car. I mean, statistically speaking, there's much more danger in front of you for other things than going on long trips.
Yeah.
But that's when it hits you. It's like, what if I'm in, you know, Uzbekistan and, you know, something happens? Because I am recommending Uzbekistan as a big vacation spot this year.
Well, a nice transition.
You're taking one of those WGN cruises. I haven't talked to Steve Bertrand about it yet, but I'm trying. We're trying to line up a big Uzbekistan tour.
That'd be good. Bring some WGN radio listeners with.
Right. Sign up for the tour, and we make out a will for you at the same time.
I wonder if Post Malone has a will. He, the popular R&B rapper who was big at the VMAs, he had a scare on the plane yesterday.
He did. He did the VMA Awards. He won a VMA Award, but also performed with the Aerosmith at the end of the show. And I think got some celebratory more face tattoos, because you can never have enough of those. Mm. His it's just not like a little something. He's got like practically the Last Supper tattooed on his face. It's very, very ornate. I'm not criticizing. I'm just saying, that's all. But so anyway, he gets on a private plane. He and I think 16 other people. They were supposed to fly to England. They depart from an airport in New Jersey. And while they were doing that, two of the tires on the plane blew out. So they had to make an emergency landing. They had to burn off the fuel in the airplane first, which I guess is standard practice when there's an emergency landing that's pending. So you can burn up as much fuel as possible.
Limits the damage if you crash.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah. Oof. So they landed fine. Everybody was fine. Yeah, right. Nobody was injured. So
we'll save our deep conversation about Post Malone for another time. I went deep on that guy about maybe a week and a half ago. Started doing a lot of research because I was singing along to one of his songs, and then I was like, who's this guy? And I started reading. I was like, oh,
you should hear this one, Dean. Justin liked the song, when he looked up who Post Malone is, he's disappointed that he looked the way he did. He pictured somebody else, and now he
wasn't just a look. It wasn't just a look.
Was it the tattoos?
No, it was
that put you off.
He's been a target of cultural appropriation because if you listen to his music, you think it's an African American. And because of the way it sounds, the way that he sounds, and then when you see his picture and he's this doughy kind of white guy with face tattoos, and then you start going to his story, well, let's read his story. And then there are a lot of reports that he's just appropriating the music because he knows he and the record labels know where the money's at.
Justin sucking the fun out of a good song is basically what it is, Dean. That's what I would say is happening here.
I know that there are cases of that cultural appropriation, but why can't somebody just be influenced by a form of music?
Yeah, and I agree completely. That's what I mean. I went down the rabbit hole. There are a lot of people who say there's
his own
that.
Rabbit hole.
There's inspiration.
I was with you. If it had just been face tattoos, I would have been with you because telling you, it looks like the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel on his face.
He has one of the whole, I don't want to get too deep on Post Malone, but he has a tattoo around the top of his scalp.
The barbed wire
at his
forehead.
Yeah,
that's on his forehead.
How's that going to look when his hair recedes when he gets older?
Yeah. What if I had done that when I was 20? Now suddenly I have all these tattoos and places where hair used to be.
All right, let's do a little rapid fire. I mean, this story is big to Chicago. Second City co-founder dies. Barbara Harris was one of the original members of the. Of the Second City,
a
loss, and she had a huge impact on the theater.
Yeah. Oh, and you know, in Chicago on live theater here as well, and many of the early Second City players, like Ed Asner, for example, who was one of the originals, tweeted this morning that he's going to miss conversations with her. And Bonnie Hunt tweeted this morning that it was people like Barbara Harris and Elaine May that set the bar for women in comedy in particular. But she and her husband and many of the people that we credit starting the phenomena of Second City in 1959 passed away yesterday. Mm-hmm. She died of lung cancer. And if you don't know her from Second City, you probably know her from some of her movies, like the original Freaky Friday.
Right, I didn't realize that. That's
in 1976. She
made 45 times.
She was in Family Plot and A Thousand Clowns. Peggy Sue Got Married. She played opposite.
Oh, I love that movie.
Nicolas Cage and Kathleen Turner, among others. She was in the film Nashville, the movie Nashville, not mm-hmm. the TV version of it. But big impact. I mean, she was a standout, really, in everything that she did. She was born in Evanston. She went to Wilbur Wright Community College here in Chicago. So she's got deep roots into Chicago, and she was 83 years old.
The other story is we'll talk about Veronica Mars. We can do that tomorrow. Danny Boyle,
fan of Veronica Mars.
I never really was, but I do know that there's a cult obsession for the show.
This is amazing to me. This show has never had big ratings, but people are so crazy loyal to this.
That's people
crazy.
Love Kristen really? Bell.
Oh,
she's
very likable.
Yeah,
I agree. So. I get that. Anyway, they're going to remake it on Hulu.
I think the story of Danny Boyle being out at 007, that's interesting because that was a big deal that he was going to be directing, and now he's out.
Oscar-winning director for Slumdog Millionaire.
Trainspotting.
Trainspotting was another of his big movies. I think one of the most talented directors. And I also was very excited when the word came out that he was going to direct whatever the 25th James Bond movie is going to be called. They haven't announced that yet. But yesterday, he and the producers came to what they're calling creative differences. So he wanted the film to go one way. They wanted the film to go another way. And he's out. He's not going to be part of this. So the movie was supposed to come out in November of 2019. Whether that is still going to happen, we don't know. I've interviewed Danny Boyle several times, and he's a creative animal. I mean, in the best way possible. He has a vision for his movies. He knows what he likes to do with his movies. You sort of know, if you know Danny Boyle movies, you know what his style is. So I don't think anyone should be too surprised, when you hire Danny Boyle to do a project, that he's going to have very definite views on how he wants it to be produced. And apparently that all fell through yesterday.
I was looking forward to a Danny Boyle-led Bond movie, but maybe next time. Maybe next life.
Maybe Veronica Mars can start working for the MI6.
Right, there you go. Dean Richards joins us every day. Talk to you tomorrow, bud. Thanks.
All right, see ya.
Dean Richards, there you go. All right, coming up, Steve James is going to join us, the director of the new show on Starz, America to Me, which spent a year in the Oak Park River Forest High School following different students. It was really a show about race, which is getting a tremendous amount of buzz, including many saying it's the television show of the year. Steve James joins us coming up after the 8:30 news.
Back to the Steve Cochran Show.
Joining us now here on the Steve Cochran Show, 720 WGN, filmmaker Steve James. His new docuseries, America to Me, is on Starz. Steve James, we've talked to him a couple times here, a tremendous talent, the man behind Hoop Dreams, as well as his Oscar-nominated film Abacus, Small Enough to Jail, as well as Life Itself, the Roger Ebert movie, The Interrupters. He's been a tremendous Chicago filmmaker with Kartemquin. This film, which is a foray into episodic television, because it's been split up over 10 parts, is one that's highly anticipated, and of course, getting a ton of buzz for its first couple episodes that has aired on Starz. Steve James joins us now. Steve, thanks for joining us, bud.
Great to be here.
Steve, how do you feel about it so far? I mean, this idea of this being such the buzz for this is incredible. We talked about it when it was sold at Sundance. Now that it's seeing the light of day, how do you feel?
Well, I'm very excited. You know, this has been a long time coming. We spent over 3 years making this darn thing, and so it's now great to see that it's finally going to get out into the public.
Do you like the idea of this being episodic in nature, the idea of splitting it up instead of the more traditional form that you've done in the past by just having a documentary?
Well, you know, a lot of people have complained about how long my films can be, so I figured, how about we'll break it into a miniseries and make it even longer? But more seriously, I think what the miniseries format allows is to really go much more in-depth into the lives of many more kids than we would have been able to do if we just focused it into or distilled it down into a single film. We follow up to 12 kids over the course of their school year. We follow the school as a whole, the sports, the prom, the homecoming. You know, it's really is an immersive and comprehensive look at 1 year in the life of this high school.
And this high school, Oak Park River Forest in Oak Park, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the community. They're screening it at the school. Many want to know how their community is going to come off when it comes to the national spotlight. What do you tell people from Oak Park when they get a little antsy about their school and their kids being in the spotlight for so long?
Well, Well, I tell them what I told the school board in Oak Park that approved us to go forward over 3 years ago, which is that we're holding a mirror up to the school and to the community over some really vitally important issues of race and education in a place like Oak Park, where you have well-funded system. You have this diverse community that's very proud of its racial history of inclusion, and yet struggles and has for decades to bridge the divide between black and white students academically. And so, you know, this series digs into all of that and tries to help you understand some of what is why that's happening. But at the same time, you see some very inspired teaching and some incredible kids that we were able to follow, kids that I think you pull for and that you... In my view, these are the kind of kids that represent this generation that's really, you know, determined to change the world.
So you have a lot of experience in following a long-term project like a school year. When you set out to do it, is it difficult to stay true to just staying uninvolved in capturing them and not trying to direct throughout the year?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this project was this collaborative effort on the part of a lot of people. Very noteworthy is that in addition to me as the series director, we had segment directors, Kevin Shaw, Rebecca Parrish, and Bing Liu, younger filmmakers than me, shocking as that may seem, who each followed stories of the kids in the series and went about the process of earning their trust and bonding with them. And so, of course, we get very attached to the kids and their families that we're following. But, you know, our job as documentary filmmakers isn't to shape the story. This isn't reality television. Our job is to empathically tell their story.
Yeah. Steve, when you talk about it, I mean, I listed some of the projects you've worked on, but you've had such an impact on telling the stories of this area. Where does this one rank? I mean, because this is something I remember talking to you a couple years back about this and how excited you were about this. Where does a project like this rank in the projects that you've worked on?
I mean, with my films, I feel like they're like your children in a way, right? So it's like asking someone to rank your children. This is the most ambitious project I've ever undertaken, and I say that despite the fact that I had an incredible team of help with this. It still, for me personally, was the most ambitious thing that I've ever attempted and the hardest thing. And I felt like it was time for me, as a filmmaker who lives in Oak Park, it was time for me to turn attention to the kinds of kids and families that grow up where I live. I have tended to focus in the films that I've done in Chicago, with the exception of the Ebert film, on kids who grow up in really tough neighborhoods and face, serious poverty and threats of violence and all of that in their lives. And this is a series about kids who are fortunate enough to not live in those circumstances, but yet they have to deal with all the obstacles of race and microaggressions and things like that that nobody escapes if you're a person of color in this country. So I think this is a really important one for me. Yeah.
The docuseries America to Me, of course, airs on Stars. It focuses on a year in the life of students at Oak Park River Forest, as well as the school and the teachers. Steve James, the award-winning filmmaker, is behind it over at Cartempwin Films. Steve, thanks for taking some time out. We appreciate it.
I really appreciate you having me on again.
There we go. Steve James. How about that? I'm looking forward to this. This is something that I've had in the last two to three weeks, I have had three different casual conversations about this program, meaning that people, this wasn't about work, it wasn't professional, it was people going, hey, did you hear about this Oak Park thing? And people from the community, people outside of the community, there's a lot of buzz. And as Bing Liu mentioned yesterday, who's on the program, one of the best television programs of the year.
It's one of those, I don't know a better word for famous high schools in the Chicagoland area. Like, it's always been one of the larger ones and things. So to get a look inside of it for a full school year, it's mind-blowing that they took it on.
I think it's a great concept on its own, and knowing Steve James and how he treats storylines from what we've seen from films like we mentioned, The Interrupters, which is just brilliant, the Roger Ebert documentary, and of course Hoop Dreams, which was the biggest snub in Hollywood Oscar history. if you ask me. Of course, Steve James, America to Me is on Stars, and it's his first. I think it's his first foray into doing episodic television as well. They're usually documentaries. As he kind of joked, his films are long, but this is one where Stars bought it, and this one we had Steve on last when. I think it was January. So when Sundance, they showed it one time,
yeah.
And Stars bought it for a record price and said, "Can we make this episodic television?" And they went for it. So that's and we're seeing the fruits of that now. So there
and,
you go.
Everything I've read said that as the series goes on, the characters you love them more and things that so it's.
And yesterday we were talking with Bing as well, one of the segment producers who had his own film, the skateboard film Minding the Gap. But the idea that they. Now, two things they have to think about. They have to think about the recently on. They have to put that. You know, it's documentary filmmakers. You don't have to do that. And then secondly was this idea that, you know, over 10, that this idea that, you know, you can follow different people as Steve James just mentioned. But also, I mean, the idea that they have to do a lot of extra work more than they had.
Yeah, it's more work. At our house, we have a debate constantly. Like, we watch Homeland, and then Pat does not like to watch at the end when they tell you what's happening
what's
next
up?
Week.
He doesn't like to do that?
He does not like to do it. And it drives me crazy because I want to know what's coming up because it's such a stressful show. And then when we're going to start a show, he'll ask, do we need to watch what happened last week? It's a discussion, each thing, before and after, if we're going to watch these things, because otherwise he'll fast forward through them. That's the big...
And what I was going to say, and I think Bing brought this up as well, it's episodic television in a more traditional value. Like, if this was on Netflix or Hulu, you would get all 10 of them in a row, and you'd be able to watch it like a documentary, but because it's Stars, it's more... the style that next week, you have to wait a week to actually see the third episode. I don't know about that. I don't know if I can handle that.
I don't know if I have the patience.
Exactly. All right, more coming up here on the Steve Cochran Show on 720 WGN.
Runners at the corners, and Kopech with the 1-2 pitch. Check swing. He went. He's out on strikes. Sano saying, I want it reviewed. The home plate umpire already called you out.
Yeah.
First strikeout for Michael Kopech.
You see the fans engaged the way they were. You know, it really made me feel more comfortable and feel like I belonged. And, you know, I just try to do what I do best and, you know, throw strikes.
White Sox! White Sox! Go, go, White Sox! Let's go, go, go!
Michael Kopech Day was a success in the sense that he pitched two innings, but he brought electricity back to Guaranteed Rate Field in a season that the White Sox are in a rebuild. It was fun to be there at the stadium last night. You know, just for the playoff atmosphere, the beginning of the game, there was a lot of people getting in their seats early. I've been to White Sox games all year long, and it, you know, there's obviously a different vibe. And they brought out the Thunderstruck and the fireworks when he came on the field, and everyone got up and stood up for the first pitch. I mean, they stood up and stayed on their feet until he threw his first pitch. It's pretty impressive.
I was trying to explain to convince my wife that actually they do that every game. This isn't anything unusual.
Well, there was a great moment, and Super Joe and I were talking about this morning that because he's at the game too. That I think it was the strikeout of Joe Mauer in the second inning because he only pitched two innings.
That was it. That was his last pitch.
That was the last pitch. That was a great moment where they got to two strikes on Mauer. I think he went 0-2, and. Everyone stood up and did that thing, and especially in winning baseball, when people stand up and they start to cheer to get that third strike.
Yep.
And Mauer fouled off four or five pitches, and the crowd, you could just see the crowd be like, I'm not going to stand up again. Like, we all sat down and let strike three happen.
Well, remember, too many stand-ups. A couple of batters before that, I think it was Robbie Grossman, where he got hit by a pitch, although it was
ridiculous.
Very, very... very marginal.
The ump was getting it.
but at that point, there were two. I think that's where everyone thought, oh, he'd struck out the first two batters.
Well,
so there's he's going to strike out the side, which he did, except he gave up the two base runners in between. But
he seemed to, I mean, I think this would have been, this is probably the best case scenario for him.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Because he gets out of two jams. He gave up two, his first and third, nobody out in the first inning.
Yeah.
I think that third and fourth inning come on, and I think the wheels come off of Michael Kopech because it seemed like
about that.
He was having a hard time keeping base runners off the base path. He escaped two jams, which
he,
I love.
He did.
I love. He did it. The rookie did it, so I'll give it to him.
Of his 52 pitches, 40 were 95 or faster.
The guy I was sitting next to was complaining about how fast he was pitching. Like when the two hits happened, he had a great thing. I remember looking at him. He's like, just enough of how fast it is. Just throw strikes or whatever he said. But just the idea right. that like they were unimpressed with the 97.
Well, he came out of his fastball right. to start, and Stoney made the point, which I thought was interesting. Which next time out, you're going to see on the gun, you're going to see that number go up a little bit.
Really?
So
I also thought, and I know we're getting inside baseball. I thought the second inning he came out with much more off speed stuff. You started to see some change ups, some different looks to the bottom part of that mm-hmm. Twins order, which he got two strikeouts out of. He struck out the side, but you saw him. And I thought it was really interesting on Joe Mauer, too. Joe Mauer is a professional hitter. He's the kind of guy you don't see in the minor leagues. And Kopech tried to blow by Mauer in the first inning. Mauer got the single. And it was a questionable argument call on the strike three for Mauer. He was arguing with the umpire at the end of that, too.
He barked a little bit, but I thought it was
we did too.
Legit call. Yeah.
Did anyone ask him in the post game if he put a lot of thought into what was going to be his first pitch, like his signature one of those fast ones, or do they have to do it for the situation?
Well, usually they don't. It's a non-swinging pitch, right? When you say that, most of the time they're going to see what you have on that first pitch.
Just for the batter,
the batter gives the first, like, just that's what we were taught in Little League, take the first pitch.
Yeah, but there are a lot of first ball, fastball hitters, too.
Yeah, right, you gotta watch out.
Get up there hacking.
Yeah, but a good game. I think it was the best case scenario for Michael Kopech. He got two shutout innings.
It was a good time for Miles. Miles was there. He got to wipe off rain off a seat, and that was his highlight.
Next time he can step on that mustard
packet. I'm gonna use that. Justin took a picture of Justin and Miles' two clean seats. Yeah. I'm going to use that for the full show post.
Also, I don't want to make a big deal about it because I don't want to get Miles in trouble. But we got home, and I was in the kitchen. I was getting coffee ready for the morning and all this kind of stuff. And I heard my wife ask him, because we just went Miles and I, and he goes, "What'd you eat at the park?" And Miles had stuff that he probably shouldn't have had. He had a cherry Coke. And we had an ice cream when it was a rain delay, right? So it's kind of dazzling.
That's what you do with a kid.
Right.
What are you going to do?
I know, but at the same time, I think, if we're trying to get out of summer.
Cherry Coke.
Yeah, that's what we went with. But anyway, he goes, nothing. Nothing. Didn't have anything. And I was like, what?
Well, maybe he doesn't count those as, it's not like he had a hot dog.
Yeah, maybe that's what it was.
Those were snacks.
Because he had eaten a peanut butter and jelly before he went.
Peanut butter, jelly, cherry Coke, and ice cream. This is a sugar.
Yeah, where was the churro?
Yeah, I know, right? I almost went to nachos after the ice cream, but I stopped myself.
Oh, those good helmet nachos.
All right, coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, we'll be joined by CLTV as well as Marilyn Katz. We're going to talk about the 50th anniversary of the 1968 Democrat National Convention. We've been doing this three-part series here on WGN Radio. You've heard Ryan Burrow all morning with part two, talking to Michael James from the Heartland Cafe days about his experience protesting in 1968. We'll talk with Marilyn about her recollections as we commemorate the anniversary this week. The actual anniversary is next week, the 28th. But there's, of course, as we lead up to this, we continue our coverage. So that's coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, so stay with us. You better think about what you're trying to do to me. Think that your mind gonna let yourself be free. Let's go back, 720 WGN, Justin Kaufman here, stepping up for Steve Cochran today, but everybody's here, Mary Sandberg, Dave Ennett, as well as Mary Vandevelle, Steve Grzanich, as we take it through till 10 o'clock when Bill and Wendy take over here on 720 WGN. Well, all this week we've been talking about the 50th anniversary of the 1968 Democratic National Convention. The whole world was watching that convention, of course. The history is undeniable. It's something that we continue to talk about even when there isn't an anniversary. But there is a 50th anniversary coming up next week from what happened here in Grant Park at the Hilton at the Amphitheater. Yesterday, we talked to Walter Jacobson a little bit about how he covered it for Channel 2 at the time, both inside the convention and out. Today, we talk a little bit about the protests that were happening in Lincoln Park and Grant Park, and of course, the riots that ensued. Marilyn Katz is with us now. She is a longtime activist and owner of MK Communications. Marilyn was the head of security. She was a security chief for the National Mobilization Committee to End the War in Vietnam and was there in 1968. Marilyn Katz, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Actually, I was second in command. Lee Weiner, who is a male, was first in command, and he got indicted, and I didn't.
There you go. So,
which was a good thing.
Let's talk about this, because there's yesterday with Walter, one of the things that we talked about was just, does history remember this event correctly? From your vantage point, all of the media that we're seeing today and this week, but also over the years, has the story been told right?
Well, there are a number of stories. There's a story of the days of the convention itself. There's the story of why Humphrey lost and Nixon won. And then there's a story of the year of 68 in total.
Right.
And from my point of view, and partly it's our own fault, is that, as true with many activists, we don't write our own history. We let history be written by people who weren't there. So, you know, partly it's our own fault. I mean, and let me take all one at a time. So one, you know, it's not only that the whole world was watching Chicago. We were part of a worldwide youth movement, a worldwide movement that saw Mexico City, saw Paris, saw Prague, saw really Memphis, a whole lot of places say no to what was going on, and really was part of a student movement for a peaceful world, an end of dictatorship, whether it be by the Soviet Union or in the United States, was for civil rights. So we were part of a youth movement. The second thing I'd say about 68 is it started with great hope. Those of us who are anti-war activists thought the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, which I won't go into, you know, was a turning point in the war. Martin Luther King, who was an iconic leader even then, had joined the civil rights movement to the anti-war movement, and it looked like somebody who was not a war hawk, Bobby Kennedy or McCarthy, was going to take the nomination. And that was in January,
right,
or February.
Wow.
Within the next 4 months, King was dead. Hundreds of African Americans were dead in the wake of King's assassination as cities burned to the ground, and Bobby Kennedy was dead. So it was a time of great hope, but by June, a time of great frustration and despair among those of us who were young. We did not have any elders who were embracing us. We were creating our own playbook.
With the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in August, does that listening to what you're saying, was there a lot of frustration on the ground for protesters and young people who were there?
So the other thing that happened that year, and remember this was the second demonstration in Chicago, that year was, as we were political youth getting involved in civil rights, in the city in general, in Von Steuben High School, on Sullivan, etc., I was a high school organizer then for STS, you know, it was a moment of transition. Girls could not wear jeans or pants to school. Curfew was being enforced, and the cops, the police, were rousting kids on the corner where Wrigley Field is now. Kids would congregate, and everybody would get busted every Friday or Saturday night. There was a lot of tension. So, and the second thing that had happened was in April, for the first time, Chicago always had very small anti-war demonstrations. For the first time in April, there was a demonstration against the war of about 3,000 people, and the police attacked it and beat people into the subways, arrested 400 people. I'm not very good at security. I was head of security then, too. I wouldn't hire me. not a career path. And so there was tension. However, remember, we were young. We were joyful. We had no skills in anything but civil disobedience and resistance. I mean, my role as code head of the marshals and security was to teach people the snake dance, et cetera. So there was frustration.
The snake dance.
Yeah, that's when you don't try it. It doesn't work, so I would not recommend it. If someone was going to attack you, like the police, you grab the person in front of you, and you tried to dance out of the park so you didn't get separated. There are other really...
I like it.
Yeah, you try. It's better at a dance party than it is at a demonstration. The other thing is, I mean, and we can talk about this later, is that it's not true that the lawlessness of those of us in the street, by the way, really staying in the park is not exactly a felony.
Yeah, and we talked to Mike James, we heard, and Ryan Burroughs.
Right, Mike is, about, you know, a good friend. We were, you know, the worst crime that we committed was staying too late in the park, which we've done for the last 2 years. But the biggest mythology and the one that I really take issue with is that we caused the loss of Humphrey to Nixon. If I asked you, when was the last time, and we can get into it later, Democrats had a majority of white votes, what would you probably say?
2008?
How about 1960?
Interesting. Okay.
1960 was the last time the majority of white people voted for a Democrat. And the first time a majority that people didn't vote for a Democrat since the end of Reconstruction.
Interesting. Marilyn Katz in studio with us.
So you're talking about the time and the climate as a young person involved. How were you received in your own home with these thoughts and what you were doing?
You know, so I was raised to be a good wife. I was a model at Saks Fifth Avenue. I went off to a girls' college, came back to Northwestern because I was getting married. I was engaged to a guy who owned a steel company. I was a sorority girl, etc. I was my parents' the ideal child. Very bright, but that didn't matter. And I heard students in the South getting beaten. And I was a sociology little star at Northwestern. And I one day at my sorority house, I hear people getting, young people like me, getting beat up on the Pettus Bridge in Alabama. And I said to myself, I really need to make history, not write history. And so within a month, I had quit my sorority, broken my engagement, joined SDS.
Wow.
And a few other things. So my family, my mother was shocked and unhappy, and my father, you know, who comes from, well, we could go into that at some other time, but in Chicago, the way of upward mobility for Jewish kids from the West Side was either the Jewish syndicate or law school. I mean, so there were only two paths. So my father was mainly afraid that I would get hurt. And at the same time, my brother was a criminal lawyer in the city, very close to Jim Thompson, who was the attorney general at the time. So on my family's part, it was embarrassment by my mother and fear for me by my father.
Marilyn
they
Katz.
They understood the issues.
Marilyn Katz is our guest. She was the co-security chief for the National Mobilization Committee to End the War in Vietnam, also an SDS recruiter. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of the 1968 Democratic National Convention and the events and the riots that ensued. When we come back, let's talk about the actual convention and the time and the park and everything that we're commemorating 50 years later. Marilyn Katz, our guest here on 720 WGN on the Cochran Show. WGN and CLTV, Steve Cochran Show. Justin Kaufman stepping up for Steve. We'll be back on Friday. Marilyn Katz is our guest. She is the owner of MK Communications and a civil rights activist who also was the co-security chair for part of the protest down at the 1968 Democrat National Convention, as well as a recruiter in Chicago at high schools for the SDS, the Students for Democratic Society. Marilyn, recollecting or looking back on this anniversary, take us to that time. I mean, to be in Lincoln Park, where were you when all of the turmoil began?
So I had two roles, one for security and one as an organizer of high school kids. I also ran a little high school shelter on in South Lakeview, Lincoln Park. So I was in the park not only during the demonstrations but leading up to it because, in fact, you know, the summer had always... Lincoln Park had always been a destination. So Friday and Saturday and Sunday and Thursday, we were holding kind of trials in the Lincoln Park, teaching people to how to protect themselves, how to go into a fetal position, or how to do the snake dance and other...
Were you, at that point, do you recall knowing there would be some sort of pushback or violence?
In April of 1968, the police had attacked a very peaceful demonstration filled with parents and their children and beaten people into the subways. So there was trepidation. Although I must say that our main fear, particularly with the Yippies coming, was that the Yippies would act out, the police would respond not to us, because we had really never suffered very much, but they would respond and take it out on the black community where there had already been a lot of death in the spring when there was an uprising in the wake of King's death. So there wasn't a lot of fear, but there was a sense, you know, we'd seen our peers in the South getting beaten. So, in fact, we took protective and proactive action. You know, and it was, you know, we were young. Nobody had been in a fight. I assure you, these were white predominantly. Remember, we're talking about the initial core of demonstrators, which was small, probably no more than 1,000 of us, and it was folks in the mobilization who were kind of anti-war folks, SDS folks, that was me, who were probably more sophisticated or thought we were politically, had a slightly different thing. But we were totally not schooled in combat. Maybe two of us had been in the army. And then there were the yippies who were mainly the theater of the absurd and, you know, passing out dope-laced brownies. And then there was, later on, Allen Ginsberg and the kind of the Ohm people came. And so that was the first night and the first couple days. And, you know, Jean Genet came, and who was a French philosopher and writer, William Burroughs, who was a writer. And it was a love fest, and we really felt loved. And then probably it was Sunday night. I can't really remember if it was Saturday or Sunday night. At 10 o'clock or 10:30, and they decided to shut us out of the park. Even though we had applied for a permit to sleep over, as many do.
The mayor and the commissioner at the time, Ed Kelly, they had said, we are not allowing protesters, any demonstrators, to sleep in the park.
Right. And in that one decision, they managed to turn a small demonstration of anti-war activists and turn that into a demonstration against the Chicago police and repression involving thousands of kids. And here's what happened. So late that night, all of a sudden on the eastern end of the park, really bordering Lakeshore Drive, you could see a huge assemblage of lights and with tear gas coming. And you could see that they had mounted fire trucks with these lights and with tear gas and in front of them hundreds of policemen. And suddenly this whole phalanx comes rolling west through the park and swinging billy clubs, spewing tear gas, and the kids, some are stoned, some are oming, and I'm trying to get people out of the park.
With your dance. The snake dance.
Everybody dance! Party! So by then I'm just saying, Allen Ginsberg, this is not going to save you, this meditation. You're not going to levitate out and trying to get all these kids out of the park. And they were very mellow. And so people are going out of the park, and they're running, and they're crying, and they're getting beaten. And suddenly, for the first time, somebody turns around, finds something in a garbage can, and throws it back. Mm. And that very moment is both interesting and in some ways quite liberating. And not only to the folks who are there, okay, we really don't want to get beat up, we're going to fight back, but to every kid in Chicago. So the next night, and as we moved to the Hilton, thousands of kids come, and they did not. These were not imports from New York and L.A. and the radical holes of a foreign country. They were the children of the Northwest Side, the Southwest Side.
So you say that a lot of kids came out after what happened the night before to say, we're not going to let this happen.
This was a homegrown demonstration. Don't let anybody tell you any differently. These kids came out. So what happened was the kids came out from every neighborhood in the city, and as Mike James probably told you, that formed the basis of Rising Up Angry, which was a youth, predominantly male youth group across the city of working class kids, the same high schools that I worked with, and that lasted for almost another decade. And the same thing happened to the adults, and you can talk to a lawyer, is not Ed Burke, but a Warren Wilson and very famous jurist, all of whom also decided to bear witness or bail us out of jail. It was a moment of transformation for the whole city. Hmm. So for youth, it was a clarion call. And 2 years later, actually, girls got to wear jeans. But and there was an anti-war movement, an anti-racist movement. And for people like Billy Singer and 10 years later, Dick Simpson, it paved the way for a change in politics. And I would argue, as I've said to you, it also paved the way for the election of Harold Washington and Barack Obama. What happened between 65 and 69 and what was expanded in 83 led to what happened in 2002, where we had the first demonstration against the war with many of the same people from 68 which led to Barack's statement against the war and his eventual ascendancy to the presidency.
Well, Marilyn's story will be told far and wide this week. She's got a piece coming out in the Sun-Times today, New York Times, other places. Of course, people are very interested in the 50th anniversary of what happened here, the 1968 Democrat Convention. A longtime activist, owner of MK Communications, and also the co-security chief for the National Mobilization Committee to End the War in Vietnam. Marilyn, thanks for coming in and sharing your story and giving us a little bit more insight to what happened 50 years ago here in Chicago.
Thanks,
appreciate
and there's plenty to do, so we really welcome people to get in contact with me and get active now.
Great. All right, coming up, we're going to have Ro Khan in studio. We'll continue the Cochran Show here on 720 WGN and CLTV. Stay with us.
Yeah, I was on the program this morning. No big deal.
Oh, how'd it go?
Yeah, not well.
How are you, man?
I'm good. I couldn't be better. I'm just you know what? I'm very excited.
Yeah, I'm good, too.
First of all, I got lectured by Jordan Kaufberg, who's on that show now.
Justin.
It was
Kaufman.
Justin Kaufman.
The promo today has stirred our fancy. Anna says Dave Navarro from the Red Hot Chili Peppers is coming up, which I'm like, oh, cool. But I'm like, Dave Navarro's known probably more for his work with Jane's Addiction.
Is that Justin? He knows his arts and culture.
I was talking too much about myself, and Steve didn't like that this morning.
Oh, so Steve went after you, too.
Yeah, I got it, yeah.
Huh.
What the hell kind of show are you running?
Back to the Steve Cochran Show.
I like where the spike with pain and music is my arrow.
720 WGN. In stepping up for Steve Cochran, Steve should be here. He should have got off the golf course and come in to deal with Ro Khan today.
Yeah.
Who's surly.
I have to say that last week, I felt like I had a very rocky outing last week. You know, I felt like I stepped in and I gave up three in the first. And then I loaded the bases in the second, and then I walked in a run, and then all of a sudden, you know, here comes Mr. Manley. He's coming out, you know, slow walking to the mound, and I'm like, we're just going to have to take you out, son. It just wasn't good.
It was
just wasn't good.
It was fine. I just Mary mentioned to us because we don't listen to your show.
Mm-hmm.
It's the last thing that we have time for. But Mary does. She heard you complaining about us.
No, I wasn't complaining. I was observing the fact that I was in Dutch from the minute I started last week.
You were the third person that day that did not follow up Steve asking how are you with a follow up to him how is he. So he seemed to really get irritated.
He got irritated with you.
And then I heard Ro call him. He said when he was talking about it on his program, he said it was like I was the Violetta of the show. Violetta is often a punching bag on their show, so yeah. Violetta said, "See how it is."
Yes,
so,
yeah.
See,
I get it, yeah.
Walk a mile, right?
Yeah, I know.
Ro
Khan. I felt bad about it. So I'm glad that you guys had me back this week. I really appreciate it. And then Steve's not here, so
he was supposed to be here.
I figure he was here like 5 minutes ago, and then he decided I don't want to be here for him.
He went out the side door. He went with the window washers down to avoid eye contact with Ro Khan.
We got a texter saying that Joe in Bensonville said he doesn't think he's ever seen a live window washing. While you broadcast it on Michigan Avenue, so this is pretty exciting.
Aerial heights here.
That's how people are so desperate to hear this show in any way possible, whether it's on the radio, the internet, or now window washing. This guy just put his ear up to the side of the window. When I walked in, I said this to Mary. I'm like, this is the happiest day of my life that they are cleaning the windows here. Because after we moved in, you know, there was still some, they hadn't really cleaned this floor, I don't think.
Right.
And there were spiders the size of your hand on the window, and they were menacing and freaking me out.
This
man.
Is their turf.
they were on both sides, too,
so you couldn't even like just look one way. They were coming at you on both sides.
Yeah.
Last night, you were at the game. You celebrated Kopech Day.
I did.
Exciting.
Sandy Kopech, as I'm calling him now.
It's exciting to be there, right? It was a whole different atmosphere.
Yeah, totally. And there was a playoff atmosphere to the game last night. And it's really, really fun, I think, for Sox fans. And it's really, really fun for the organization, too, because, you know, all of a sudden there's an energy. You got this whole season, every month I felt a little bit more energy in the stadium because I think Sox fans are starting to feel and see, baseball fans are starting to see and feel the move that's being made here. And, you know, there are teams that sit in the doldrums for decades at a time. I'm very familiar with that. And you're like, oh, they don't really have a plan. They don't have a plan. They don't have a plan. These guys have a plan and it's starting to come together. And since we saw that happen with the Cubs, it's really fun to see this kind of happening
future
now.
Superstars, yeah. Right. I saw a kid, when I was walking out, a kid had a Kopech jersey already.
There were a lot of them.
Yeah, I was like, wow, good. And you know what? I got to give the guy a lot of credit. And I also say that that's the moxie on this kid to be number 34 in the city of Chicago.
Well, that's based on Nolan Ryan, right? But,
sure.
But it is still, when I saw that he's 34, you're thinking, wow. I mean, that's, you got to really be doing something right there to wear a 34 in this town.
There you go.
Yeah.
Of course, the rain delay. But we were talking about it earlier that it might have been the best case scenario for Kopech because, you know, he worked out of two jams in the first two innings. And, you know, there's no the Twins were coming back through again. And he could easily not worked out of a couple jams and had a more tarnished first outing.
Right. And he faced Mauer twice. That's that guy, that monster from Minnesota. So I mean, and Mauer, you know, got struck out to end his run in the second, and that was a pretty scary moment. Anyway, the point is that it's fun out there right now because you're getting this sense that things are coming together, and then these other two kids that everybody is, you know, with bated breath waiting for, Eloy Jimenez and Luis Robert probably not coming up this season.
No,
but Eloy Jimenez, it does seem that they're going to bring him up. And even though that could hurt them, you know, 5 years versus six, is that how that goes in terms of how long they will have him as a rookie
on a rookie contract?
Yeah.
But you know, the ironic thing is as much attention, I mentioned this earlier, as much attention and deservedly so that Kopech's debut got, the guy who's really been pitching well is pitching this afternoon, Carlos Rodon. And there's a first-round guy who's pitching like it right now. And he's a young – I mean, he's another young pitcher.
But that's the point, right? All of a sudden, you're starting to see there are three real guys right now in the starting rotation. And you're starting to see there's power. There's some defense. There's still there's still things they got to work on, right? I mean, I sit around. I was talking to during the rain delay last night. I was talking to Ed Farmer, and just dropped that name, by the way, in case you're wondering.
That's a good drop.
And and Darren Jackson, and it was very interesting to listen to them. You know, the difference between the beginning of the season and now, you get a real sense of and these guys are at every game, right? They're watching everything and they're thinking about everything. And they're, you know, we were there for some very disappointing, awful moments. At one point in the middle of the summer, those guys turned to me when I was up there and they were like, this is the worst baseball I have ever seen. Right? I mean, and so, you know, now to have this kind of turnaround, it's very fun.
It's cool.
It's fun. And this is going to be a moment, I think, in Chicago sports anyway, because, you know, hope springs eternal, as it always does. But with the Bears, there is, even though
a little bit of a youth movement,
the first three preseason games have given me zero hope for just about anything. But there is, you know, you got a lot of talent. The Bulls are talking about being serviceable. Is that a nice way of putting
it? That's a good place.
You got Northwestern. Northwestern football is going to be very exciting. Northwestern basketball, got the new stadium.
Yep.
You got Notre Dame's going to be good this year.
And even though we are a flagship, the Chicago Cubs are the best team in the National League. So.
Right.
There's always that, too.
Exactly.
I love that now in Chicago we just forget about that. Like, they won a World Series.
Now at WGN we forget about it for sure.
And you also ought to mention the Blackhawks,
right?
Who are
I was getting there.
Oh, I figured.
Rokan show with Anna DeVellante is every day 3 to 7. All right, so let's do this. The White Sox play today, right?
It's Rodon Day, didn't you hear?
Rodon. And then Rokan right after Rodon at whatever time, at 4 o'clock-ish. We'll be on the stream starting at 3 o'clock as normal.
Let's take a break here so we stay on time for Bill and Wendy, and then we'll find out what's coming up on Ro's show afternoon.
As soon as I find out.
What do we got coming up at the 10 o'clock news?
Back to the Steve Cochran Show.
720 WGN, Steve Cochran Show, Rokan. Okay, so what do you got on the show? I mean, you've talked so much because you already had you on the show yesterday. So Michael Cohen and of course, the Paul Manafort verdict. I mean, it's amazing to me.
Man. But I mean, what that hour—they call it the hour of the Trump presidency right now, that 3 o'clock Central Time hour yesterday, and we were here for it. You know, well, all the best stuff happens in the afternoon.
Did you see the tweet? I'll just let the week lead on this. This tweet that came out about an hour ago.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump: if anyone's looking for a good lawyer, I would strongly suggest that you don't retain the services of Michael Cohen.
I wanted to.
Funny.
You know what I'll do? I actually will tweet him back and say, "What about Mike Monaco? Monaco at law?" You know, I don't know. There's a lot of fallout today because Republicans have got to figure out where they're going to come down. You know, Duncan Hunter, who's a Republican congressman from North County, San Diego. He and his wife got indicted yesterday on campaign fraud.
Nobody saw that, right?
And he was, you know, one of the first, you know, Trump guys. This guy last week, 2 weeks ago, who was also an early Trump supporter who just got indicted.
Congressman, yeah.
And Collins. And so, I mean, the things are kind of falling around him, and he's got to figure out how he's going to respond to it. And, of course, he responds on Twitter. And so we'll just have to see what happens as that continues.
He's doing bits. That's a good bit.
You know, I got to say, you know, there's a moment where, we were listening on the way to the game last night to the whole, to a speech in West Virginia. I kept waiting for him to dive into this. And he does have discipline about things like that. He's not, he kind of knows when to fold them. He's definitely a gambler, but he folds them at precise times. And so it'll be interesting to watch him through this.
Rokan, the Rokan Show with Anna DeVellante, 3 to 7. It'll be on the stream, WGNradio.com, for the first hour. And then after the Sox are over, back on here, 720 WGN. Ro, good to see you, bud.
Thanks.
All right, coming up, Bill and Wendy, stay with us.
This is 720 WGN Chicago.
Bill and Wendy here now. Hey, guys. Good
are
to see
you. Are we going
to
Mexico, Bill?
Yes.
You are?
Yep.
For that same trip?
No. Yes.
Wow.
We just invited ourselves. I hope that's
come on. Both shows could do it,
yeah,
don't you think?
We'll do it. Well, we'll go. That'll be fun.
Like Socks on the Beach too?
Yeah, well, sure. Yeah, we could call it that. Sure. I like whatever you want to call it. We just want to go to Mexico.
Socks.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, Michael Kopech. Ow.
Oh, I know. He
he's
is
a good looking guy, yeah.
Oh, man. And pitches well.
Is that why
well
they brought him up, do you think? They needed a handsome starter?
I will say, I was at the park last night. They used that. I mean, I've never seen a starting pitcher on the scoreboard as much as he was before the game started.
Yeah.
They were using every time, everything he did, if he was on the bench, if he was talking to somebody, they just went as close as they could to his face and they put it on the scoreboard.
They explained early on, because, well, everything was early on for him. He was only in the first two innings. But he looks like a guy, they said, when you look at him, it looks like it's 105 degrees because
his hair gets wet.
It gets very sweaty.
Yeah, he definitely looked in the first inning,
didn't he?
Like he had been standing in a shower.
Yeah, like a sauna.
Well, when you're throwing 100 miles an hour,
the heat just working. Permeates you.
I hope he keeps the long hair just because I think that could be a nice little.
The guys from Chicago Fire were next to him on the mound. I don't know if you could see it, but to put him out at any point, they didn't know if he was going to burst into flames.
Isn't that what the rain was about?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
To douse him.
Right.
He only threw, he pitched two innings, and his pitch count was at 52, I think, in
52.
Two innings.
Yes.
That's going to be his issue. There's a lot of foul balls and a lot of 3-2 counts, things like that.
But so they had Alex DeBrinkert ready to come in.
Right, they did.
Which I had an issue with. I'll bring it up off air. And he didn't go to the mound to throw the ball. He just went about halfway through.
Okay, you're going to take the
issue.
No,
I'm just saying. I saw the sister Mary Jo went to the mound. She talked about getting on the rubber. You know, like that. I'm just saying. Like you would think that there's a precedent that's been set by the nun that you would follow the nun. I mean, everyone loved DeBrinkert. He came out and it was a huge standing O for him. Everyone loved it. But he got out there and he's like, "I'll throw from the grass." You're like, "No, I didn't think he could do
mound.
That." Mound.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So much for Alex DeBrinkert being a regular on this show.
I said everyone loves him. Everyone loves him. What do you guys got coming up on the show?
Well, Katie Rich, who is a comedy writer, writes for Saturday Night Live. She'll be on. A friend of yours.
Yeah, I love her.
And then also a woman who we thought used to be on the Waltons.
Why do you say things on the air sometimes?
It's true. We booked her because we thought she was on the Waltons, but she wasn't.
Well, it's
Michael
a different
Learned's
name.
No.
Not Michael Learned,
Megan
Mary.
Megan McDonough is a singer-songwriter. She did some Patsy Cline stuff in the Always musical. Yeah. And the one from the Waltons is like Mary Kay McDonough.
Yeah, we thought she was coming on, but she's not.
We'll talk Waltons with her. I'm sure. Hey, I'm sure she watched it.
Everyone watched the Waltons. We'll talk about that.
Waltons wall to wall.
Yeah,
Bill and Wendy.
Good night, Justin.
Good night, Jim Bob.
Good night, Mary Jo.
Nice mole.
You two have been visiting the Baldwin sisters.
The Steve Cochran Show celebrates the most valuable person on the planet weekday mornings at 720 on 720 WGN Chicago.